France, 1955. The legendary 24 hours of Le Mans endurance race is 2 hours old. Teams of drivers will be trading places, pushing a fast machine from 4 o'clock in the afternoon all through the night until 4 p.m. the next day. It's thrilling and dangerous. Fans pack the stands near the racing pits, watching the brave racers speed by. Mike Hawthorne, in his powerful Jaguar, leads the pack. But he needs fuel, so he'll have to make a pit stop. He passes Lance Macklin's Austin Healey first. Hawthorne then hits the brakes so he can enter his pit. Macklin hits his brakes, but can't slow down in time. He has to swerve into the path of a Mercedes bearing down on him at 150 miles an hour. What happens in the next few seconds will change the course of motorsports history forever. I'm Les Stroud. I've survived some of the deadliest environments on Earth. But there are some things that even I might not walk away from. This is Deadly Disasters. Today, the Le Mans crash. The 24 Hours of Le Mans is the world's oldest and most prestigious automobile endurance race. For 24 hours, teams of three drivers push themselves and their machines to the limit. Whichever team goes the farthest wins. Since 1923, it's been run on the everyday streets of Le Mans, France, about 125 miles southwest of Paris. Michel Bonti has written several books about this legendary race. The media center at Le Mans is named after him. No one understands the history of the event better.
In 1923, at Le Mans, the authorities and the club of the ACO succeeded in obtaining permission for the race to be 24 hours non-stop. And it became a world competition in about 10 years.
On June 11th, 1955, hundreds of thousands of fans arrive for the race. It's a beautiful day. The sun is shining. The air buzzes with excited voices. People are ready to watch some of the best racers in the world drive all night. Since the race goes through the city streets, fans mill about local boutiques before the opening flag. Other fans bring tents and baskets of food. They'll camp on site until the race is finished. This is as much a party as a sporting event. Denise Dawn, a young mother, is dressed casual but classy. She's looking forward to a day out with her husband Rene, dark-haired and handsome in a crisp shirt and sweater vest, and their 11-year-old daughter, Danielle.
I wasn't terribly passionate, but I went above all for the ambiance, for the pleasure of spending a day in the countryside. It was very nice. The race started at 4 o'clock, so we left in the early afternoon to see the start, and we wandered around a little inside the grounds of the 24 hours, because there is a celebration. There are plenty of attractions. There are plenty of things. And then we went to the edge of the track to watch the start.
Jacqueline Chotard, a spirited brunette in her 20s, is a big fan. She's been following the world of the Le Mans race since she was a child.
Oui, nous sommes vraiment passionnés beaucoup.
Yes, we are passionate about it, really. We really like the circuit. We grew up with it, living nearby the racing circuit. We've always been interested in the 24 hours. We would often walk on the circuit with my parents, my grandparents, and later my husband. And now, with our grandchildren.
Chotard is so in love with the race, she's attending with her new husband, Bernard, on their honeymoon.
I was just married. And my husband took a week off to fully experience the 24-hour race week. We went on the circuit to see the Jaguars entering the track.
Bernard brought his film camera to document the day.
Et on avait filmé.
I went and filmed the unloading of the Jaguars and the race preparation. Cars arriving, taking their places.
Top companies like Jaguar and Mercedes enter three cars, each with two or three drivers who trade shifts during the 24-hour race. The athletes prepare for the grueling hours ahead. Mike Hawthorne is considered to be one of the best in the world. He'll be driving the number six car, a forest green Jaguar. Lance Macklin is driving the number 26 car, a Kelly Green Austin Healey. Mercedes top driver is Juan Miguel Fangio. He's a three-time world champion from Argentina. He'll be in the silver number 10 car. His teammate, Pierre Lavin from France, is driving the number 20 car, another silver Mercedes. Paul Frere, who is driving the green number 23 car for Aston Martin, doesn't think much of Lavin's ability.
Lavin was a driver who had most of his glory years behind him. He was never that great a driver anyway.
Frere thinks the safety precautions of the day are substandard too.
What I didn't like of racing was the dangers that were there at that time. The races were very much more dangerous than today. Because the cars were not as safe as today. The driver was not protected against accident. There was no belt, and if the car rolled, there was not even a roll bar.
The course itself is treacherous in parts. One of the most dangerous sections is the narrow straightaway near the pit and the grandstands. It's only 3 meters wide, and cars enter this section at speeds of over 150 miles an hour.
The straight lines of La Naudière are very debated, especially at the time that they were built. Some drivers were against the idea, and the ones that agreed believed that cars were going too fast on straight lines.
This hazardous mix of car, course, and driver is about to change racing history. As the race draws even closer, fans begin to fill the stands. Jacques Hayet, a freelance journalist, seats his wife and son, and then makes his way to the press box.
In 55, I was a young journalist. I was 28 years old. I worked at the sports editorial. And on the race on Saturday, I found myself on the big press platform.
Denise Don, her husband René, and daughter Danielle start walking to the track to get a good view. In the stands, the crowd is packed shoulder to shoulder. René, Denise, and Danielle want to get a good spot, but René sees some friends. He stops to chat. The conversation may put them a little further from the race, but Denise doesn't mind. She's more interested in socializing than watching the race anyway. Unlike Denise and René, Jacqueline Chotard and her new husband are both crazy about motorsports. They wouldn't dream of missing the start of the race, especially one as unique as the 24 hours of Le Mans. The race begins on foot. The drivers line up across the tarmac from their vehicle. When the flag drop starts the race, they run to their car.
That's how the start was back then. The drivers jumped into their car. So everybody wanted to catch that moment. No one wanted to miss that part.
The flag drops at 4 p.m. Drivers sprint about 10 yards to their cars. Aston Martin driver Paul Frere recalls the start of the race.
The driver was in front of the car, if I remember. The car's door was mandatorily closed. We were running at the car and jumping up the car. Sometimes we were jumping over the car's door to be faster.
It's not an ideal way for the drivers to begin a grueling contest. Former world champion Juan Miguel Fangio leaps into his Mercedes. His pant leg catches on the gear shift. It puts him behind his rival Mike Hawthorn in his Jaguar. Michel Bonte wrote a book about this very race. He remembers the start well. It had a big influence on the events that were about to unfold.
Fangio part mal. Il fait un mauvais...
Fangio had a bad start. He's 14th, and Hawthorn is already almost two paces ahead. So there is a duel that will be born. And then there is reputation. Hawthorn is a young driver. Fangio is already 3 times world champion of Formula One. And he sees this guy who leaves before him, and it angers him. So he'll do everything to catch up. He'll pass, he'll take risks. Fangio will take a lot of risks to remain in the same lap as Hawthorn.
2 hours later, the caught pant leg is still influencing the race. Fangio's Mercedes may be the fastest car in the race, but the delay at the start has cost Fangio the lead. He's just behind Jaguar's Mike Hawthorn in first place. Neither racer is willing to give an inch. They burn through the course, sometimes only a foot apart. The two are engaged in a hellish battle. At the side of the track, Mike Hawthorn's crew signals for him to come in for fuel. Hawthorn blows past the signal. Maybe he doesn't see it. Maybe he just doesn't care. Fuel be damned, he's not going to give up the lead. Not yet, anyway. On the next lap, Hawthorn ignores the signal one more time. He can't do it again, though. His Jaguar is running low on fuel, and it's time to change drivers. Jaguar's policy won't allow him one more lap. Still, Hawthorn is determined to push as hard as he can while he's still behind the wheel. 3-time world champion Juan Miguel Fangio is in second place in his Mercedes, looking for even the smallest opportunity to take the lead. Both drivers believe they are the best, and they're determined to prove it. Hawthorn and Fangio have lapped almost every other car in the race. Now they approach Pierre Levin, Fangio's Mercedes teammate in the number 20 car. Levin isn't the same caliber of driver as Fangio, even if they both are driving a Mercedes. But Levin is a proud man, not willing to be passed by someone in essentially the same car, especially not in front of the jam-packed crowd in the grandstand. If Fangio wants to pass Levin, he's going to have to earn it. Levin won't give anyone a free pass. The two Mercedes racers scream down the course in fierce competition. Everyone in the grandstand is riveted to the drama on the track. But as they watch the drivers enter the straightaway, they have no idea that death is coming with them. The world's most elite endurance motor car racers are battling for supremacy in the 1955 24 Hours of Le Mans. Just a few hours into the race, Mike Hawthorn's Jaguar approaches the narrow straightaway. He's in the lead with the two Mercedes drivers in hot pursuit. Hawthorn needs to stop for fuel on this lap, but he can't afford to lose any more time than necessary. Hawthorn decides to pass one of the slower cars before he hits the pit stop. His Jaguar flies past Lance Macklin's Austin Healey. Once Hawthorn clears Macklin, he hits the brakes hard so that he can enter the pit. This is no problem for Hawthorn. His Jaguar has the most powerful brakes in the race. But it's a huge problem for Macklin. His Austin Healey is far inferior to the Jaguar, especially its brakes. With Hawthorn slowing down in front of him, Macklin brakes hard, but it's not nearly enough to avoid a collision. Macklin swerves to the left. This puts Macklin's Austin Healey directly in the path of Pierre Lavin's approaching Mercedes. Lavin is desperately trying to hold off his teammate, Juan Miguel Fangio. The silver number 20 car screams down on Macklin at 150 miles an hour. Lavin instantly reacts to the danger to both himself and his teammate. Lavin sticks up his arm to warn Fangio of the imminent crash. It's all he can do before his Mercedes collides with Macklin's Austin Healey. The silver number 20 Mercedes rolls up onto the sloped back end of Macklin's Austin Healey and launches into the air. Le Mans superfans, Jacqueline and Bernard Chotard, see it all happen right in front of them.
All of a sudden, I saw the car, the Mercedes, literally taking off the ground above the people. And then I thought, this is terrible. That car is going to land on the crowd.
Lavin's silver Mercedes hits the concrete upright of a pedestrian tunnel. The gas tank explodes. The image Bernard Chotard sees next burns itself into his consciousness.
J'ai vu un ventre blanc.
All of a sudden, I saw a huge white flash.
Il y a eu un instantané photographique.
This image is frozen in my mind, as if I took a snapshot of it.
Je me souviens vaguement avoir vu donc des objets noirs qui filaient.
And right after, I saw black objects smoking and smoking again.
The once mighty machine disintegrates like a child's toy. The engine rips from the chassis of the car and plows into the stands packed with spectators. The hood whips 100 yards across and over the spectators, then descends to the human height, decapitating rows of spectators. Denise Dawn, her husband René, and 11-year-old daughter Danielle had just used the pedestrian tunnel. They see the chunks of burning metal flying towards them. Denise shields her daughter, hoping that they will not be hit by the flaming debris.
I put her against me. I put my arms around her. Myself, I turned my back to the accident and I held her in my arms. The only thing she said was, "Take me back, my hair's burning," because there was an immense heat coming from that car which had fallen. That's when she went to find her father.
Superfans Jacqueline Chotard and her husband Bernard are uninjured, but they see the carnage unfold. The horror in front of Jacqueline is all too real.
Right after we heard people screaming, and I'm still embarrassed to talk about it. It was so awful. People were shrieking, screaming. It was panic all around. Nobody knew where to go.
Bernard Chotard had been shooting race footage on his small camera. He runs to the scene.
J'ai dit, je vais voir. Alors, j'étais avec ma caméra.
I said, I'm going to check it out. So I went there and started to film, although I had to stop because I could see some people were staring at me. So I thought, well, maybe I shouldn't be filming at that point. I remember, it was like a battlefield.
Denise Dawn and her daughter find her husband, René. He's unhurt. Thanks to that conversation with some friends, the family arrived at the stands later than planned. The Dawn family was just seconds away from a fiery death. René is stunned by this stroke of luck.
We were between the first group killed and the second group, and we found ourselves more or less in the center. In all likelihood, we would have been in with the people that were killed by this motor.
On the track, Juan Miguel Fangio's Mercedes navigates past the wreckage. Fangio nearly misses the collision thanks to the final gesture of his teammate, Pierre Levin, who now lies dead on the track. Sports journalist Michel Bonte will never forget Levin's last act of heroism.
This gesture of Louvet, Fangio would later say, it saved my life. Why did it save Fangio's life? Because in raising his hand, he warned Fangio that he must not pass him before having passed the little car.
Lance Macklin's number 26, Austin Healey, comes to rest on the pit side of the track after the collision with Levin's Mercedes. Macklin's car is wrecked, but he's miraculously unhurt. The other drivers whiz past on the narrow straightaway. Paul Frere, inside his Aston Martin, speeds through the crash site on the straightaway. Like the other drivers, he's oblivious to the tragedy in the stands.
I never realized that there were so many deaths in the accident. Because where we were on the track, we couldn't see the dead bodies like the public side did. We didn't know that a spectator was part of the accident. We only knew that later on.
Race officials don't know what's happened yet either. Sports journalist Michel Bonte recalls that yellow flags are waved to slow traffic, but the race continues unhindered.
There was no panic because the accident was contained to an area of about 150 meters on each side. There were no spills on the track. The race continued, which was, in my opinion, the most important decision that was made. It was highly criticized afterwards, but in fact, it was the most intelligent decision since, as long as the race continued, people continued to watch the race.
On the press platform, reporters are unaware of the horror below, including reporter Jacques Haye, who had seen his wife and daughter to their seats before the race.
We saw a collision. We didn't pay a lot of attention at that time because we didn't imagine that there was an accident like that. But when we saw the smoke, at that moment, my department head told me, I think there's been something important. Go see. So I climbed down the press platform and then did the 200 meters, 250 meters, towards the crowd.
Haye is shocked by what he sees. Medical aid arrives to help the 100 or so people who are injured, some badly. The dead are everywhere. Dozens and dozens of lifeless bodies lie broken on the ground.
The paramedics arrived. There had been journalists who had come, drivers. I don't know anymore who had come to help pick up the bodies. Help had arrived quick enough there. The ambulances, all of them arrived. So me, I went back towards the platform to say, there's a situation.
Jacques Haye looks desperately for his wife and son. Finally, he sees them among the fans fleeing the scene. They're safe. Jacqueline and Bernard Chotard are still near the wreckage.
I also have that image as we were leaving the circuit. Panic all around. And cars. People's cars were taking the injured away and were waving handkerchiefs as a signal to let them go through. They were driving the injured to the hospital.
The day started as a party. Now, It looks like a war zone. The dead are laid in rows by the dozen. Many are headless. The maimed are being treated or rushed to the hospital, and still, the race continues. Night falls on the 24 hours of Le Mans. Paramedics and rescue workers clear away the wreckage from the crash. Officials don't stop the race because they don't want 300,000 fans leaving the event to block the ambulances who need the road. On the course, Mercedes is leading by 2 laps. During the night, Mercedes headquarters orders their remaining cars to withdraw from the race. Sports journalist Michel Bonte recalls the controversial decision.
Because it was a decision that for a long time provoked much discussion. Stirling Moss, for example, who was the teammate of Fangio, whom I met at the race this year, told me that the worst thing Mercedes did was to withdraw from the race, because withdrawing meant in one way or another that Mercedes felt guilty. Yet he told me that we had nothing to feel guilty about in this affair. It's a fact of racing.
The Mercedes cars pull off the track. The race ends at 4 p.m. the next day. Jaguar's Mike Hawthorne, whose pit stop had started the chain reaction that led to the crash, is the winner. Paul Frere, in his Aston Martin, finishes in second place. But by this time, the crash has overshadowed the results. Eighty-two are dead. Another 100 are injured. It's one of the worst crashes in auto racing history. Fabrice Bourigand, who represents L'Automobile Club de l'Ouest, recalls the fallout.
There was a great inquiry that took place for over a year and a half. Behind the verdict was known in 1956.
The world waits hard to find out who is to blame. Is it Mike Hawthorne, who braked hard in front of Lance Macklin? Is it Lance Macklin, who swerved in front of a speeding Pierre Levan? The inquiry assigns blame to no one.
Macklin's judgment did not voluntarily cause an accident. Hawthorne passed the car less quickly than he. He had to stop to the best of his abilities. So, his maneuvers were simply a result of a number of factors. It was a reasonable thing to do at the time, but it just wasn't enough.
The inquiry doesn't wash its hands of the tragedy, though. It suggests implementing safety measures to the track, including a widening of the narrow straightaway and moving the pit area further away from the grandstands. Driver Paul Frere explains.
After the accident, the entire zone was redone. The stands were demolished and reconstructed several meters to the right in an attempt to enlarge the road at this spot.
The horrors of the crash are particularly haunting for Paul Frere. Although he was driving an Aston Martin, he had been offered a spot with Mercedes. If he had accepted, he would have been driving the car that Pierre Levan died in.
Sometimes I think that if I hadn't had Aston Martin that year, that there would be 88 or 90 more people still alive. I think that sometimes, but that's the fatalist in me.
The crash of 1955 echoes through the lives of any who saw it. Denise Dawn, who cradled her 11-year-old daughter as fiery metal rained all around her, had seen enough.
I vowed that very day not to go to the 24 hours. I said, I'm not going anymore. I'm not going anymore, and I didn't like it when my children were taken, or my grandchildren.
Bernard and Jacqueline Chotard, who grew up loving the 24 hours of Le Mans, still maintain their passion for the race.
On y pense, hein? Chaque année on y pense. Chaque année on pense à l'accident.
Every single year we think about the accident. But you know, we keep on going. It's a habit and I go to accompany my husband. He loves it. He really enjoys going to the 24-hour race. He's always lived in that atmosphere. And now the whole family gets to enjoy it as well. I hope my grandson Mark, who has never missed a race, and he's only 12, that he will do the same. That he will take over from us when we won't be around anymore.
The tragedy also leaves its mark on the sport. France stops automobile racing until it's made safer. The Le Mans pit area and grandstand are bulldozed, and the replacements are built further away from the track. The track itself is widened, with a deceleration lane added before the pit. A slight curve in the course is also removed, so the cars approach the pit area on a proper straightaway. Others make even more drastic decisions. Switzerland foregoes any safety measures and bans auto racing completely. Lance Macklin, who swerved in front of Pierre Levin, retires at the end of the season. Levin's Mercedes teammate, Juan Miguel Fangio, never races at Le Mans again. Mercedes abandons auto racing completely for 32 years. They don't return to Le Mans for another 12 years after that. Racing cars has never been safe. Danger is part of the appeal. But 82 people paid the ultimate price for attending an event that day in 1955. Their loss still echoes throughout the sport. This episode of Deadly Disasters was produced by Ajit Parkal and Miklas Perlis for Storios. Adapted for audio by Craig Colby. And sound designed and mixed by Brian Eimer at Images and Sound. This podcast is adapted from the television series Disasters of the Century. Our executive producer is Ron Getz, and our supervising producer is Robert Lachlan. Deadly Disasters is a production of Partners in Motion. I'm Les Stroud.